The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. In the United States, particularly in a city like San Antonio, medical professionals are regularly called on to diagnose and treat patients who are nothing like themselves. They didn't grow up in the same kind of communities, in the same kinds of families, even in the same countries. They don't speak a shared language, and their patients' gender identities may be different from the ones they were assigned at birth. There's really no way to be an expert if you're a healthcare professional in all of those other things, but research has shown us time and time again that if medical providers don't work to acquire some level of cultural sensitivity and inclusivity, their patients just aren't going to do as well. And no medical professional is okay with that. So many of them are trying to learn. That's one of the reasons UT Health San Antonio has established its Cultural Inclusion Institute, founded by UT School of Nursing professor Dr. Norma Martinez-Rogers, and she joins us to talk about its mission today. Also joining us, the Dean for Inclusion and Diversity at UT Health San Antonio's Long School of Medicine, Dr. Chiquita Collins, and Dr. Peter Guarnero, an Assistant Professor of Nursing at UT Health San Antonio, who is also the Director of Nursing at the Pride Community Clinic. He's with us. Now, if you'd like to talk about your experiences with cultural competence and inclusion and share your thoughts about how to improve the relationships between medical professionals and patients, please give us a call at 210-614-8980. We'd love for you to join the conversation. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
All right. Yes, joining us on the phone is Dr. Martinez-Rogers, and let's start with you. I'm sure you've run across people who think, you know, a doctor or a nurse or doctors and nurses, a human body is a human body. Blood tests are blood tests, but it's not really that simple, is it?
No, it's not.
So why does cultural sensitivity and inclusion in healthcare matter?
Well, first of all, the population is very different today than it was 10, 15 years ago. And we are going towards a value-based, patient-centered care system. And because of that, patients are demanding more personal service, open communication, and higher levels of rapport. Going to see a healthcare professional is very personal. And you, in order for a minority or someone different from yourself to feel comfortable, you have to be able to understand who they are. But before you get there, you have to understand, first of all, who you are as a person. And then you will be able to better adjust and better help the patient.
Okay, Dr. Collins, it seems one of the solutions to the cultural competence issue in healthcare would be making more diversity in healthcare professions a priority. Am I right about that?
That is true, and there is a national discourse to identify best practices and how to do that effectively, and that's been our biggest challenge. But just to hone on the point in terms of cultural competency, you know, a lot of people have some connotation in terms of what that really entails, and it's quite dynamic, complex, and it really involves a ever-changing process in terms of teaching our healthcare professionals or providers and tending to a ever-growing, changing population. And so it's not just those who are on the margins of society, but it's also in terms of, back to Dr. Martinez-Rogers, you know, point, in terms of those who are different from ourselves. And so how do we, you know, accommodate based on a variety of different skill sets?
And that's something you focus on in your job over at UT Health.
Oh, absolutely. It's multi, I would say, in terms of my responsibilities, it's really covering the entire medical enterprise as it pertains to our learners, our faculty, as well as those who are in the role of providing patient care, you know, so that runs the gamut. So there are multi ways in which we kind try to address that. And most first and foremost is really changing the organizational culture, you know. So for us to expect that someone will be trained or skilled based on just one exposure of some type of, workshop or webinar. We really have to change the dynamics of the organizational culture so that we have leaders within our administration who are committed and invested in diversity and inclusion carries over to all of those who are part of the institution and enterprise.
So it becomes a part of the culture.
Absolutely.
Right, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Dr. Guarnero, your area of expertise is nursing, and you have specifically concentrated on the LGBTQ community. What are the needs there that aren't being met in the current climate?
The greatest need is finding healthcare professionals who are culturally sensitive, who understand what their life experience is like. If you go to a doctor's office or a clinic and you hear a trans person, for instance, if they hear the staff misgendering them, that's very humiliating. So what is really needed is preparing the next generation to be able to be culturally sensitive and know what language to use.
Right. At this point, it's a subject in which people struggle. Medical professionals are humans, and some people still don't understand how transgender works. So how do we sort of educate professionals that are humans too, with human failings, about what is going to work?
So what we do at the School of Medicine and the School of Nursing is every semester we have what's called safe space training. It's really an introduction to understanding what sexual orientation is, what gender expression is, what are the different terms that are used to describe the LGBT community. We also teach them to be very careful, to be very sensitive to using pronouns. So at the clinic where I'm director of nursing, what we do is we always ask the patient, what are your preferred pronouns? And then that's entered into the database so that when the faculty, the physicians and the nurse practitioners and myself, we get the list of patients, it says very clearly the preferred pronoun is Z or her. And that allows us to be very sensitive. So when patients come to see me for an assessment, I look at the sheet and now I'm prepared.
And it really doesn't matter what you think about it. It just is about compassion in the end.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? So we are having a community conversation about this, and we want to hear from you. Are your doctors culturally competent? Do they get you? That's important. Have you had negative experiences with a medical professional not being culturally sensitive? What we want you to do is give us a call at 210-614-8980. You can email thesource@tpr.org or give us a tweet at @tprthesource. You're listening to The Source. I'm Bonnie Petrie. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies, and we're talking about the need for cultural inclusion and cultural competence in healthcare. And I think for me, the most stark example of this is maternal mortality. Black American women are 3 to 4 more times likely to die from a pregnancy-related complication than non-Hispanic white women. This cuts across all income brackets. It doesn't matter if you're a lawyer or work in the service industry, have a graduate-level education, or didn't graduate from high school. Some speculate this is because Black women in particular, but people of all minority cultures, experience a sort of benign neglect throughout the lifespan. Medical professionals think they're treating all their patients the same way, but there's this implicit bias, the systemic prejudice at play that even minority healthcare workers can unknowingly exhibit. Dr. Chiquita Collins is with us. How can that play out?
So implicit bias can be powerful because it is unconscious and unexamined. And all of us who, whatever race, creed, ethnicity, gender, age, we all suffer from it to the extent to which, although we are well-intentioned individuals, especially those who are in medical care or health care, there's a tendency for us to often rely on our lived experiences, our limited exposures to other people from different cultures, what we see in the media that tends to perpetuate stereotypes. All of those things combined really influence our decision-making processes. And if you add the layer by which many of us, in terms of in the healthcare industry, often are in very high demand positions and time stress constraints. Therefore, you tend to automatically react or respond based on, again, the stressors by which you might undergo in terms of that interaction with a patient. And so say, for example, hypothetically, you walk into a room and your patient happens to be an African-American woman, and you get distracted. And then all of a sudden you revert back to tending to your patient, and you realize that you're thinking about your other patient whose needs might be greater or other things that might be going on in your head. And so you have this exchange, and the first thing that comes to mind is that this person might not necessarily comply to my orders. This person might be not as intelligent, because, again, we automatically revert to some pervasive stereotypes that are not always true. And then, unfortunately, sometimes someone may act and respond in that manner. And so that might be somewhat, people may perceive it as be reaffirming a stereotype. And so we have to get into the business of learning how we deal or mitigate our implicit biases. And there are many tools that exist. One in particular is the implicit association test that's been generated by social psychologists at Harvard University. And it is a tool to increase our awareness so that we become consciously aware of some of our shortcomings when we're in those time pressure type of, you know, incidents. And so as an African-American woman myself, I have my biases, and so even though I train in this area, I'm more aware than maybe the most, you know, a normal or common person, I still have to make sure that I don't engage in certain types of assumptions about people. So I'm probably more inclined, and you know, most people who are in the healthcare industry have egalitarian viewpoints or perspectives,
sure, yeah.
Right? And so we have to make sure we train our learners. It's not just a one-time deal by which they're exposed to, I've taken the test, and so therefore I would never be, you know, biased towards anyone. It's an ongoing, ever process by which we have to make sure that we equip ourselves as well as empower our patients to be aware of how do you, you know, advocate for self when you're in a situation by which you're not quite sure of the instructions given by your provider. So you have to ask those types of questions so that you can gain greater clarity.
And I think that the maternal mortality numbers are put into stark relief how devastating and sometimes lethal it can be to not have some level of cultural competence. And by the time a Black woman gets to her OB, this has been going on for a long time. And perhaps doctors and nurses, as you've touched on, aren't even aware that they're doing it, but somehow her healthcare has fallen through the cracks so that when she has a problem with her blood pressure or her blood sugar or any number of other things during pregnancy, it can suddenly become lethal in ways it might not for other people.
Absolutely. And you cannot ignore the context by which health arises, right? So the social environment by which someone lives plays a major role in terms of access to resources in order to educate oneself or to know that there are certain things I need to do so I won't be in that situation. So it's complex, but we need to make sure that we cover all bases as pertains to the outcome or health outcome of an individual or community.
Peter Guarnero, do you see this kind of benign neglect and implicit bias in the LGBTQ community?
Oh, absolutely. Not only here in San Antonio, I've actually lived in, I spent a part of my life on the West Coast, and also lived in New Mexico and Chicago. And people make assumptions. We as professionals make assumptions that someone is not interested or they don't care. But many times it's not that they're not interested or that they don't care. They don't understand. And it's and many healthcare professionals, because the time constraints. They don't take the time to explain a medication, like an antihypertensive, or if it's someone who's HIV positive and is on antiretrovirals, you know, to explain, you know, that you have to take this every day. You cannot skip. And sometimes the constraints, because you don't have time, and you sort of put it in the back burner, and it stays there, and the patient goes. Mm-hmm. And then a month later, they come back, and you ask, have you been taking your medications? No. Why? Well, because I don't have money, or I don't have a car, or, you know, things of that nature.
And there are resources with which they could be helped if they had that kind of relationship with their doctor.
Absolutely.
So they knew that was what was going on. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Have you had a negative experience with a medical professional not being culturally sensitive? We'd love for you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 210-614-8980. And I mentioned earlier that sometimes people are undertreated, as you just touched on, because they haven't had good communication with their doctors. But sometimes they just stop going to the doctor completely. Can you talk to us about that, Chiquita?
Well, two things in terms of back to the point of competing demands and prioritizing, especially if someone of low income status, are they're going to make some type of judgment call, okay? Whether or not they have transportation to get to the hospital, whether or not they have child care priorities. And so it's more complicated and complex. And so I would also bring into the discussion that there's a level of mistrust and distrust in certain communities that is still prevalent. And so if we don't address those issues, they're more inclined to not seek out services because of our historical past by which certain communities were targeted and viewed in a very negative light. And so you have the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, for example, which is notorious. It was a 40-year study by which they intentionally infected African-American men to see the latency, the progress of syphilis without being treated, you know, with medicine to alleviate that. And so you have that one incident, and there are many others by which, you know, if we have not addressed that in the communities by which they have been targeted in the past, then we're not going to get to where we need to be in terms of ensuring that once you're there, their healthcare providers are there to help you.
So with that example alone, we have an entire culture for generations that is suspicious of medical providers. Dr. Martinez-Rogers, you founded the Cultural Inclusion Institute at UT Health San Antonio. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I founded it 7 years ago, and mostly because what we saw was that I'm a Latina, but what we saw in the Latino population is that there were so many barriers to getting access to care, to language, health literacy. And so we decided to, it was a group of us, we were throughout the schools of our professions, the medical school, the dental school, and then the School of Nursing, just with Dean Breslin's blessing, who is our dean of the School of Nursing, gave me permission to start the Cultural Inclusion Institute. And we have, every year that we've had a conference, we have focused on the social determinants of health, which are what happens to, how this affects the health of our people, of all people. You were giving some statistics a little bit ago about African-American women. Well, African-American women also, 67% are more likely to die from breast cancer than white women. And African-American infants are 2.5 times greater to die than white infants. So the stats are really, really, really high. What we did notice is that, and why we started the Institute, is because we continue to lag, minorities continue to lag, and quality of care, access to care, timeliness, and outcomes. This could be, and I think people do mean well, but there are biases, just like Peter and Chiquita were saying. It is these implicit biases, sometimes they're unconscious, but they come across. Maybe the patient only speaks Spanish, and even though you may not say it, you might think it, well, they're in America, they should be speaking English. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is a bias that you have. So when we started the Institute, we decided to do these conferences. And we actually have a following. They're interactive conferences that we give. And this year we're focusing on the LGBTQ community, mostly because last year we had a faculty member talk about her daughter, who was transgender, and she talked about the experiences that they had in going through with the changes, the surgeries, and he is now a he, and he is addressed as a he. And that's what Peter says, is that you have to identify people as they want to be identified.
Absolutely.
But she
talked
about all her emotional issues that went with it, the family issues and the community issues.
Dr. Martinez, Rogers, thank you very much. We're going to have our conversation joined by Laura, who is a Latina. She's applying for medical school. Thank you for joining us at 210-614-8980 on The Source, Laura. So how has that experience been applying for medical school?
Yes, thank you for having me. Yes, you know, I am currently, you know, preparing to apply for medical school. And I just want to add to this conversation because I think it's really important, you know, if we want to increase cultural competence in healthcare. My background is in global health. I studied at Northwestern University. And one of the things that you know, I really, you know, I encountered some discrimination there in Chicago. And, you know, I feel like cultural competency and diversity shouldn't just be glory words. You know, medical schools, graduate programs should make more efforts to include, you know, minorities, you know, undocumented minorities and minorities coming from low income, marginalized communities. Also, you know, minorities that are transgender or queer. And I believe that this is the key in building empathy. And also, you know, these individuals, you know, they might not have the financial means to go to pursue medicine, but they have the emotional intelligence and the empathy to really make a difference and to change healthcare for the better.
All right. Thank you so much, Laura. Dr. Collins, that's something we touched on just a bit ago, the need to really make it a priority to make the medical field more diverse.
And along those lines is that we want to represent the communities we serve, the patient population we serve, and we are growing more diverse than ever.
All right, you two can join this conversation on The Source right now at 210-614-8980. What are your experiences with systemic cultural bias in medical care? The Source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies, and we're talking about the need for cultural inclusion and cultural competence in healthcare. Dr. Norma Martinez Rogers from UT Health San Antonio is joining us on the phone, and you touched on something that I think is really important to elaborate on just a bit, the social determinants of healthcare. Tell me and our listeners a little bit more about that.
Well, the social determinants of healthcare are really encompassing in terms of your level of education, the community that you live in, if you live in an underserved area, medical area, if you speak a language other than English. All of those are considered factors that affect your health. So, who do you hang around with? Are there medical facilities near you? Those are all what we consider to be barriers to health. So we call them the social determinants of health. And there is a recent document on, it's called Missing Persons, Minorities in the Health Professions. And this was the Sullivan Report on the workforce of the healthcare professionals. And from that came out with NIH, who also said that the social determinants of health affect your quality of care, what kind of how often you go to get health care. Uninsured people fall under the social determinants of health. Undocumented, those who didn't finish school, those are all part of the social determinants of health. They determine the quality of your life, mm-hmm. and that's why they're called the social determinants of health.
For sure. Let's go to the phones, and joining the conversation is Robert at 210-614-8980. Robert, you work in the hospitals, and what are you hearing and experiencing?
Oh, yes. Well, actually, I'm a student who has been doing some internships at some different hospitals and other clinics. And I've been surprised at the number of jokes that people say about various various races, or especially right now, it seems like transgender folks. And I've never actually reported it or said anything about it. But I'm curious as what your guests think is an appropriate way to handle those sorts of situations.
Peter Guarino, what do you think about that?
Excuse me. I think you have to be very careful. You have to understand the institutional culture and how flexible or how open it is to taking complaints. So usually actually one of my students has done, he's now working at a local hospital here in San Antonio. And what he did, he actually took the Safe Space training and it has become part of the nursing internship at the hospital. So all the nurses, all the nurse residents that are going through that program are becoming more culturally aware in terms of language, in terms of the needs. But I think it's important to, again, to understand the culture of the institution and who is it, who are the gatekeepers, and can they be engaged in a conversation to bring about change within that institution?
We'll talk more about the safe space training that's going to happen at UT Health San Antonio, free and open to the public in just a few minutes. It's really important stuff. But what do you do when this happens, like what happened to Robert, and you start to maybe talk to your higher-ups or just say, no, that's not okay, and people are like, you don't have a sense of humor. You're a wet blanket. Get out of here.
So my response to that is a multifaceted approach. And what's important is that the institution takes responsibility in devising a policy, an anti-bias policy, by which it addresses incidents or hypotheticals by which our providers might encounter, or vice versa. So it's going to require educating our staff, training our staff, empowering our patients so that they are aware in terms of appropriate behavior. Sometimes most hospitals have patients' rights and responsibilities, but they're somewhat limited in addressing this. And so it's not just one hospital. There's an uptick across the country that we have heard in which our providers are experiencing various types of inappropriate behavior towards mm-hmm. them. And so we have to make sure that we, I would say, implement policy, training, and increase educational awareness.
All right. So we have Robert, or actually Gene, on the phone now. Gene, you've experienced some implicit bias in a San Antonio hospital?
Yes, absolutely. Actually wasn't in San Antonio, it was in Dallas. But, you know, my son is in college. I'm an African-American. I'm from an upper-middle-class family. So my son had like 102-degree temperature, and this was last year when all that flu was going around. And he called me. I said, son, go to the hospital, go to the emergency room. They probably need to admit you. They admitted him to the emergency room. It was about 12 o'clock at night. And I called back, and I said, do I need to come up there tonight and check on my son?
I'll be right there.
So one nurse said, son, I think you need to come right away. And I'm like, why did she say that? Well, once I got to the hospital, I found out they were mistreating him, basically judged on his hairstyle, because he had this kind of nappy hairstyle. You know, the young black guys are wearing this hairstyle now, and that's, you know, it's kind of unkept. But they associated him with being someone from the area that this hospital was in. It's in the outer Fort Worth area, as displaced, homeless, and they were really mistreating him. And I found out, and he told me, he said, they said, "Are you on drugs, young man?" They gave him a catheter without any type of whatchamacallit, you know. And I was like, wow, I was shocked to hear that. I mean, I'm a retired military. We got health care. He's a smart kid. He's an honor student on a football team and such. So I was appalled to hear. And I was thankful that that nurse told me to come up there right away because she saw things that weren't right. And just the way she said that, I knew I should come up. So I'll let you guys chat.
That sounds like a terrible experience as a parent and for your son. Thank you so much for sharing it. Dr. Collins, there are a couple of things there. You represent the perspective of the nurse, perhaps, as you all work in the field of healthcare providers. And that nurse advocated for his son. But also, how does a patient who doesn't have a nurse advocate like that, how do you manage that whole situation?
Back to my point, you know, we have to ensure that we increase awareness throughout, you know, and so we can empower our patients as they come in about, you know, certain, I would say, not necessarily regulations, but, you know, to have signage, to have, you know, literature. Again, all multifaceted approach to increase awareness in terms of empowering the patient. If this happens, this is what you should do, A, B, and C. You know, don't allow. If you see something wrong, say something. You know, so, and that's so simplistic in terms of what I'm saying at the moment. But again, we have to give them skills in, as it pertains to increasing educational awareness so that they can empower themselves. And I would always say the best advocate is self. But what if you're in a situation where you can't speak up for yourself? It is a two-way street. We have to make sure that we educate those who are part of the enterprise as well as empowering our patients who walk into our hospitals and clinics.
Dr. Guarnero, I was going to ask you how nurses' role plays out in all of this, and now we have an example from a caller how a nurse's role can play out. You are a professor of nursing. What is a nurse's role in all of this?
The nurse's role is to advocate for the patient, to be the, in some instances, and some people would disagree with me, to be the voice for the patient. Because many times patients, because of language or because of a variety of factors, may be afraid to ask a question. So I think it's the nurse can speak for the patient, not speak for the patient, can help them articulate what is going on inside their head, mm-hmm. and help them bridge that gap to be able to talk, for instance, to the nurse practitioner or to the physician or to the physician's assistant.
So I've often said nurses are my favorite people, and that's one of the reasons why. Let's go to another professor of nursing on the phone still, Dr. Martinez Rogers. Is it better to see a doctor who is like you, whose background reflects your background? How do patients go about finding culturally compatible providers?
Well, you know, most of the people don't that are minorities, most minorities don't have a choice of what type of professional they're going to have. We do know that you're more likely to have satisfaction in your care and have higher quality care if you see someone that looks like you, someone that understands who you are. What the gentleman was saying earlier in terms of the gentleman that called in, that is a perfect example of things that occur many times with minorities. It not just minorities, but the underserved population who can't speak for themselves. There is a reason why we say that minorities don't have the best quality of care, and that is because even though we might mean well, healthcare professionals don't know how to address some of the issues that we have. You can't, if you tell someone you have to take these medicines every day for so many days, and do we take the time to say, can you afford this prescription? Where are you going to get the med? Do you have a way to get there? Do you have someone that can help you? a perfect classic example of this is that a patient left the hospital and nurse told the patient's wife, he's supposed to take these medicines once a day.
And somehow that did not happen. We'll talk more about that straight ahead. You can tell us what happened, Dr. Martinez-Rogers. Coming up, we'll talk about the conference they're going to do at UT Health San Antonio about all of this. And you can call us at 210-614-8980. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. And we're back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies, and we will touch base again with Dr. Martinez-Rogers straight ahead. But this show is inspired by a conference y'all are having next week at UT Health San Antonio on this very subject. It's called Promoting Health and Well-Being Through Social Justice and Cultural Inclusivity. And so let's talk to you, Dr. Collins. How does social justice work as a goal of healthcare? That's big.
That is big. And I would say this would be in alignment with promoting inclusion. And the idea essentially is to promote civility and respect. And as people are people, we rely on our humanity. So we shouldn't take into consideration all of those negative stereotypes of assumptions that we make about people. And so there are ways that we can mitigate that. You know, it's just like anything that we can unlearn, you know, not to say that we will completely eradicate. But again, we can be informed and empower and have knowledgeable training to kind of mitigate those things.
Frustratingly, the term social justice has become somewhat loaded in the current culture. But is it something that should be a goal of medical professionals?
Well, you're talking to a social scientist, and so I'm going to say absolutely. And here I am in the context of working in a medical field. So I commend medicine to be more forward-thinking and accepting our perspectives and our lens and our research to kind of get them to where they can be as it pertains to incorporating more social justice type of, you know, awareness.
All right. Yeah. Dr. Martinez-Rogers, I heard you start to speak there. Tell me your thoughts.
Well, it's very important that we address social justice. Well, anytime you're talking about cultural competency or cultural inclusivity, it includes social justice. And, you know, we continually say we all mean well, but it's about learning about who you're working with. And I tell students when I've talked with them, I tell them in order to become culturally sensitive, it's a lifelong learning. It to be culturally sensitive. This is not something that, I know it today, so I got it. It's not like that. This is a lifetime experience. And what it is that if you don't know who you are as yourself and aren't comfortable in your own skin and who you are, then you're not going to be comfortable with others. Because it first begins with you. Cultural awareness comes from within yourself.
Absolutely.
So that is really, really important.
For sure. And Peter Guarnero, you are leading that session free and open to the public, so anyone can go, called Safe Space Training, Becoming an Ally to the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Communities. So what is the most important thing a straight, cisgender healthcare provider can bring into a visit with someone from that community?
Understanding who the person is. And also, if you're working, for instance, if you're working with a trans person, your frontline staff should also be prepared to be very careful with their language. Mm-hmm. Because many times it's the frontline staff who misgender. And again, if you're sitting in an office and you're misgendered, it's very humiliating. So it's preparing the frontline staff and then letting the information flow through the clinic so that everyone is aware of how this person wishes to be addressed. And that's one of the things that we'll be doing. And I'm not actually, I will be assisting during the faith-based training. One of my students, Ron Menard, will be leading it. Safe-based training at the School of Nursing, the School of Medicine, is led by the students, because I want them to take ownership of it.
It sounds great. Sounds very interesting. Now, we've talked a lot about minorities. I sit before you as a white, straight, cisgender person, but poverty, which is something I know from my childhood, is another thing that can play into cultural competence that is necessary to understand where your patients are coming from. And we have a caller now, and it's Rose. Thank you so much for joining us. You've had some issues being low income in your interaction with medical providers?
That's correct. My father, who was 90 at the time, and he lived to be 95, but he had a urinary tract blockage. Mm-hmm. He went to a nephrologist. The guy said, oh, well, he's lived 90 years. What do you expect? And did nothing. And so it just got worse. We only got him to the hospital when he fell and broke a bone in his hand before they had a chance to address the urinary tract blockage, which was then at, his kidneys were then at stage four. He was, you know, at the door of death. As soon as they put in a catheter, suprapubic had to go through the stomach to put in a catheter due to the blockage. His kidneys were at the functioning at the age of a 20-year-old the very next day. Wow. So, and it was because he was a Medicaid patient and a super nurse and a super doctor who was working on minimizing the amount of resources used for Medicaid patients. I got that from a comment that the super nurse said, well, why are they dragging this patient back and forth to the doctor? Not realizing it had taken me 2 years to get him to the hospital.
So, Dr. Collins, it sounds like Lisa's preaching to you.
Yes, she is.
What's on your mind?
There's so many isms in our society, and you were just mentioning both ageism and poverty, that individuals who, again, are vulnerable and considered, you know, margins of our society often get, you know, different types of care. There's no justification for that, and I'm sorry you had to experience that. But again, it hones the point and emphasis that we have to ensure that our health centers and healthcare organizations create environments that are affirming and welcoming to all, irrespective of who you are. And so, to the point that I made earlier, you have to start off with making sure there's investment and commitment at the highest of levels, and having a policy and training all of those who are part of the enterprise. And so we're going to get there, and I remember optimistic. It's just a matter of doing it.
All right. On the phone also is Lisa. Lisa, thank you for joining us on The Source. You're a retired nurse?
Yes, I'm a retired nurse, and my husband is a practicing physician here in San Antonio. And I went into nursing because I love taking care of people, and I have huge empathy for the stories that I'm hearing. However, in my husband's practice, he has physicians. They're Chinese American from Ecuador, Mexico, Pakistan, and India. And when I took care of my aging in-laws, I was in several medical centers and found lots and lots of really diverse healthcare providers, you know, of all races and ages. And I think that many, many healthcare providers provide excellent care without judgment of, you know, gender and income. My husband does surgery on undocumented people from Central America and Mexico, and his practice and the hospital don't really get any kind of compensation for that. And in fact, one time he actually got in his car and drove to a patient's home and brought him into the clinic because he didn't have a way to get there. And with that said, his practice includes social workers and psychologists, and they will often provide lots and lots and lots of services to low-income people. And yet some of them don't take advantage of what's being provided for them. So my point is just that I think there's a lot of compassion in healthcare providers, and I think that we're trying to get as many services as we can to those that are needy. And so, you know, for the woman, I feel so bad whose dad was 90 and was treated like that, and the African-American man, and they thought his son was just a thug. But please also know that there's a lot of really compassionate, excellent care coming from the heart without judgment.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Nurses are my favorite people. I'm a pretty big fan of doctors, too. Dr. Martinez-Rogers, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are. The caller is absolutely right. There are many, many healthcare professionals that are very culturally sensitive and culturally inclusive. And as you know, the nursing profession is the most trusted profession that there is in the United States. So it's a good thing you like us. you know, it's the impact of those few that don't do it. I mean, there's a reason why there are so many African Americans and Hispanics who die of diabetes. We are more apt to die of illnesses than the white non-Hispanic population. The few healthcare professionals that do not give compassionate care because maybe they don't know how, or maybe they have biases, really affect not only the patient, that patient's family and that patient's community. So it's a domino effect. And yes, there are good people that, like this woman's doctor,
for
I was
sure,
wondering if
yeah.
he perhaps was working in a federally qualified healthcare center.
I'm just going to interrupt you because we're approaching the end of the show, and I want you to be able to give the information on the conference again, if you can. Tell us when, where,
It is at the Menger Hotel. Our conference is 2 days. It's on the 24th and the 25th. But the free part of it will be on Thursday, April 25th, from 1 to 2:30. And that's when we're going to give safe space training.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you all for joining us today. Thank you for calling us. And thank you to our experts in cultural inclusivity in healthcare, Drs. Martinez-Rogers, Collins, and Guarnero, all from UT Health San Antonio. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies, and you've been listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio.